interview with Professor Edward Feast of the English Department. August 11, 87.
We'll press this down, and we will go at... You have a soft voice, so I'll put it fairly close to you, something like that.
Is that working now?
It's working now. Yes.
So I don't have to say testing, testing.
Oh, you don't have to say a thing.
This is Edward Feast, English Department, Associate Professor Emeritus at the present time, 1987. Retired 1984. That Orwellian year.
Yes.
I came to Stony Brook, which is to say the State University of New York, and Stony Brook is what it later became, but this was Oyster Bay in 1957. And I think I was 40 years old at the time, give or take a year. I came from the city colleges, precisely Brooklyn College and Queens College, and I was a lecturer at Queens College just a year before. I can't answer the fourth question. I don't think anybody was primarily responsible for my coming to Stony Brook other than myself. Nobody recommended it, and nobody pushed it. As a matter of fact, I was more often warned against it than encouraged to come by others outside who interviewed me for position.
When did you
here.
Join Stony Brook?
1957. September 1957.
You were one of the, really.
That's right, the very first.
Were you the first person in the English department?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
I see. Yes. All right.
And it was Dean Olson who interviewed me for the position here with... I don't know if anyone else interviewed me before I was hired or not. I can't remember. And I can't answer very clearly the next question, why I came and what factors are most important in my decision. I think the factors were that it was a new institution starting up with some ideas behind it, some interesting personalities, and some interesting directions in the future. I think the seventh question is the kind of thing I've tried to answer by implication. Impressions of Stony Brook when I first came, that's very, very hard to answer. Don't forget these are the impressions of Oyster Bay.
Oyster Bay, that's right.
And when... I first came, it was, in the first place, very difficult to find. By looking at road maps and so on. In the second place, it did not look like an educational institution at all. It was a mansion. And to go to a mansion, as I think I did, that was it, late in the afternoon. Whatever particular day it was, it was odd to find there a secretary and a man, Dean Olson, and then a 60-room mansion. But we finally got together, and as I remember it, at that time I was recovering from a foot infection, so that I wore a slipper sock. And Dean Olson interviewed me and asked, how would you teach so-and-so? Something in the field of English, of course. I would get up, and as I got more animated, I would get up and start walking about, as I've always had the habit of doing when thinking or when teaching. And the slipper sock would remind me that I shouldn't walk quite so much. It was... All in all, a pleasant interview, and I thought a most unusual technique, since I wasn't asked anything except how I would teach this and that subject, what my approach would be, and how would I handle this particular problem or whatnot, and no other kinds of questions having to do with all past academic experience, position, did you know so-and-so at such-and-such an institution, the usual pattern of the interviewer habits.
He probably had, did he have your vita?
Yes, so I assume he had everything there, and yeah. Didn't want to ask questions about what was down there in black and white in front of him.
Where had you done your advanced work?
At Yale.
At Yale.
And before that at Wesleyan University in Connecticut.
Yes, that's my alma mater.
As a matter of fact, I suppose he just simply took the attitude, that's all very good, now let's get on to this. And the, what he went, bent, what persons, what experiences
stood
out in your mind, you don't want to get onto that yet.
But just a minute. What kind of a person was Dean Olson?
Well,
I need some feedback on that.
Controversial. Well, Dean Olson was a serious student of philosophy, and one seriously and honestly committed to what some people would consider the Chicago Great Books idea, to give it a oversimplified description.
Right.
I think he was committed to it to an extraordinary degree, and I was myself never persuaded that the thoroughness of that commitment was an altogether good thing. I didn't think he was flexible-minded enough. I was hired, I think partly, because I had been chairman of the freshman composition program at Brooklyn College a couple of years before, and before the freshman composition program was changed by Harry Giddens, the president, and it was understood that I would have something to do with the I would be in charge of the freshman composition here.
I see. Mm-hmm.
And, yeah. Okay. Yes. Tom Rogers was...
May I remind you of one of the things that you came back from your first interview from a very early time there, that you, this was a college that had a dictionary, a telephone book, and the two-volume Plato, Dialogues of Plato. That was the...
Extent of the library?
The extent of the library, and I mean, that was...
Well,
the,
that was
the,
behind that was, Olson's desk.
Yeah, I mean, that was what it was. It was, and it told you something about the kind of place it was, that it began with the telephone book and with the Aristotle.
Yes.
And that marked the institution for the first few years with some bitterness as it developed.
Yes, that's true.
And some of that bitterness survived. 25 years later, people are still arguing about some of those things.
And I think also one of the things that emerged from Olson's questioning is that he wanted to be assured that, I guess, the people he was hiring, myself included, were fairly well-educated men and women. So his questions would be something like, what do you think you are, an Aristotelian or a Platonist? That old... philosophical question, which I could field as to show that I had heard of these two gentlemen before.
Yes.
There was one other thing, it seems to me, that marked the early, very early, early days, is that we didn't know what kind of a place it was.
Yes.
Because nobody that came to it wanted to go to a teacher's college. But because of the problems in Albany, it still was not called a university. And so people would say, well, what is it? And you would mumble and say, well, It's not a teacher's college. You defined it negatively rather than positively.
Well,
because
the
intention was, and the understanding was to everybody, that it was going to be a full-fledged university, but because of the Blagan report and all that business, you couldn't be open about it and totally candid, and so there was...
But on the other side of that, when I talked with my friends and colleagues at Queens College, Brooklyn College, about this and told them what happened during the interview, they said, most of them, oh, the guy's an educationist, forget about it. I can see how, in a certain coarse kind of thinking, Olson's interviewing might fit into that, you see, as though he were interested in educational technique.
Nothing to be
heard. And that was, oddly enough, not the truth.
Right. Educationist is a pejorative term.
Yeah. Oh, yes.
He was very much interested in education, and that was what was appealing about it.
No. So that, you say what events, what persons, what experiences stand out in your mind. I was thinking about a couple of these things while chopping wood, and here is one of them. It occurred during the first year of our operation, or possibly during the second, but still in Oyster Bay, not later than the second. A gentleman had undertaken to drive a lady up from the south, an academic man, driving one of his colleagues up from the south to pay some kind of visit here on Long Island. And when he arrived here, it occurred to him that he'd look up this new institution he'd heard about at Oyster Bay. And so he put in some inquiry or other to Dean Olson, and I don't know if there's a misunderstanding between them or not, but in any case, the man arrived, and Dean Olson sent out the word. By that time, we were installed in our offices, and this happened to be a day in which, about middle of the day, when most of us were around. There were sort of about 9 or 10 of us from that time. We had... This is the second year of operation, so we've gotten a little larger than the original dozen. We all gathered in the conference room next to Olson's office, a white big table there, and the man was at one end of it, and 8 or 9 of us, including Dean Olson, were ranged around it. The questioning began, and began in a very genial kind of way. We complimented him on finding the place, first of all, simply because it was so difficult, and people would wander around the village of Oyster Bay and ask all kinds of questions, and sometimes they weren't clear what kind of institution they were looking for, and they would get answers like New York University, well, that's way back in the city, in the wrong direction, turn around, go back. But in any case, we complimented him, and we passed on a lot of light talk about various things. The ground outside grounds that he just passed through until more serious questioning started. I forget the man's subject, and I'll say with vague memory that I'm right, that it was history or somewhere in that general area. So it started kind of how would you teach? And went on, the man was particularly cheerful. He answered our questions. And it bounced back, all bounced back and forth from one questioner to another, all very courteous, for about 25 minutes. And at the end of it, when the pause was fairly long, the pause showed that all the business was over, silence fell, and this cheerful, jolly man perked up and said, "Very well, gentlemen, when do I get the degree?" And I thought that was very good, kind of very delightful commentary on something. And the man was not candidating for a job. He had simply come in as a curious outsider with an academic background, and he got much more than he bargained for. But it was an indication of the kind of mindset that I suppose we all had.
Anybody
so kid
who came in was fair game.
That's right. And anybody who came in was looking for a job, too.
Yeah.
Well, and
then besides that, anybody who came in had to be very carefully looked over because he might be just the kind of, shall we say, educationist in a figurative way that we all disliked. Some rote, trained person.
But everybody was really intellectually excited, even though you didn't approve of them. They were, were really that Chicago Hutchins rhetorical consideration of major questions. Everything was grist for that mill, and that was intellectually exciting, even at the same time that it offended and annoyed the, what you call them, the scientists, the modernists.
Well, no, my...
The but old arguments.
The second incident that I recalled while swinging my axe is one having to do with the discussions that we held regularly, at least once a week, perhaps more often than that, on just the general intellectual matters and curriculum planning. And this is the second year, in my recollection, or possibly the third. And Cliff Schwartz, a man of pronounced views then and now, pronounced views which he often pronounces, was in the group and always took a very strongly anti-Chicago line. And I recall at the end of one of these debates, which of course involved more than the two people, the one person I've named and the second one who I'm going to name, but at the end of this, Harold Ziskind very wittily proposed a question for the next session. And I forget precisely what the question was. It was, of course, intellectually relevant, very tidy and very neat, but he ended it up by saying, and I don't want to make this a cliffhanger, with a smile in the direction of Cliff. And I think that, in a sense, gives the atmosphere of a
friendly
discussion in which there were strongly expressed views, but also some humor and some graciousness. So that, I think, is quite revelatory. If you want something even... incidentally, both these incidents are both of them trivial, but they give, I think, some impression of what you call atmosphere.
Right, yes.
The third, equally trivial, that I will mention is that one day the alarm went up that the kids were building a baseball field out on the Great Central Lawn at Oyster Bay. And they had laid down a first baseline before this kind of sacrilege was stopped. I think this was our first year. So that I guess you might comment here that some of our students did get to first base in the first year. They didn't get much beyond it. It was a class that, as I remember, since it was recruited very late in the year, was a class of students drawn from the group who had failed to go elsewhere for various reasons. Lack of
there was supposed to be a whole planning year.
Oh,
and
yes.
Then,
well, that was so.
And then in the spring...
He never had it.
Planning year. So in April, when you decided to admit students, the students that are available in April are not the top of the barrel.
That's right.
Yeah.
That's right.
Although they turned out, some of them are still with us and turned out pretty good. Mm-hmm. Wasn't Les Paul doing well?
I don't know.
No, Les Paul was not the first.
Wasn't he in the first year?
No. If there was anybody good
in the first graduating class, there
the first graduating class, there was Carl May, M-A-Y.
And there's a PhD in chemistry.
And whether she was in the PhD in physics, you mean, who person who later became a teacher of physics in the local schools. I forget her name.
Oh, no, but in that first class had someone who went on to get a PhD, not from Stony Brook, but in other words, that first graduating class with a bachelor's degree in chemistry includes, there were two chem majors, and they both got PhDs. So that's, for the statistics, so you have 100% of the bachelor's degree got a PhD in chemistry.
Right, two questions. Approximately how many students in the first class? Do you have an idea?
That's a hard one. If there were 30, more than 30?
At Lizard?
I doubt it.
Oh, there were 140 or 120. The way I remember,
yeah.
I don't have any.
Yeah.
That's not how many graduated.
The mortality was so great that I have no very clear picture.
I mean, some of it was terrible.
Yeah, and some really dropped out after a few months or even weeks. So I have a very fluid idea of that.
How many faculty?
Oh, during the first year,
there were only
a dozen.
Can you name it?
Count Olson. Can I name
him?
Oh, yes.
Frank Erk.
Harold Ziskind.
Dick Levin.
He was Tom Rogers. Ed Feast.
Cliff Schwartz?
No, Cliff Schwartz.
I see.
Frank Erk?
Yeah, we've mentioned him. Emmanuel Chill.
Yeah.
What's his name? Fleischer? I forgot his name.
Marty Fleischer. Len Austell? Is he a faculty member?
Len Austell, as Dean of Admissions, was there from the beginning, but he didn't do any teaching. Did general advising.
Are we counting?
Who?
Are we counting?
When did Fausto Ramirez come?
Not until he came in the middle of the second year.
I see. What about Eisenberg?
Not the middle of the second year, because not even Francis Bonner came there.
Francis came in the middle of this, and then Fausto Lestre.
Yes, so Fausto came after.
Leonard Eisenberg, yes. Leonard was in the first year, because Leonard was there before Francis, and Leonard was there before Cliff.
Yeah.
And Leonard was the one who was not part of this.
Right.
Chicago, call it the Chicago group, but it's not fair. But he was a philosopher,
physical scientist.
Yes.
Frank Erk was a biological scientist.
Francis Kennedy.
And then it should also be mentioned Bowen, Ralph Bowen.
Ralph Bowen, that's right.
What about mathematics?
And in mathematics, the name Kalachowski comes to mind. Is that right? He was one who left us after about the third or fourth year.
You want me to go get the catalog?
No. But I seem to remember somebody like Kalachowski.
All right.
Lister
was
mentioned a little later.
Bill Lister.
Okay.
What about Irving Gerst? When did he come?
Now you're getting into engineering.
That was much later.
And that's much later.
Yes. As the time.
Well, he was applied math, yes.
Uh-huh.
All right.
There was the math and applied math wars.
Yes.
You have to hear about those for other people.
Right. I don't understand that myself. But they still continue in a way, though. The library does. So I understand it.
Okay.
There's a question here about were your activities confined to the Stony Brook campus? And I think after the first or the second year, after the first or the second year, I got attracted into what you might call representative activities, which eventually took me very often to Albany and to other places in the state system. It came about because...
Representative of the faculty?
Well, yes. Because while I was at the institution in its first 2 years, I was president of the tiny AAUP chapter.
I see.
And that went on until I became a sort of poobah and all sorts of activities, eventually being senator representing the institution at the Senate of the State University of New York, Faculty Senate of the State University of New York. I think I was on that for about more than 6 years. as well as being later on in member of something called the Committee on Governance of the Faculty Center of the State University of New York, so that we went around, and this is all much later, and really applies to Stony Brook, but not to Oyster Bay. Much later we went around to the various institutes and looked at the constitution, the faculty organization, and the position that the president took in such matters. So that, in answer to question 13, I guess up until a few years ago, I had many more connections with that kind of thing than anybody else on the faculty.
Well, now, I don't want to confine this simply to Oyster Bay.
Right.
When I came in September of 62, the faculty had been through some difficult times, shall I?
Yes.
Can you describe those?
Well, I think it was the, I have a folder somewhere, which I gave the name.
Let it go to the archives when you're through with it.
I think I sent some of that to Edward Walker's already, but probably more coming when I clean out my my files. But I think I called this folder the Case of the Three. The Case of the Three got into the newspapers, and particularly into Newsday, and we got featured in Newsday day after day, it almost seemed at times, because the these three people, largely under the leadership of Ralph Bowen, Bowen with Marty Fleischer and Emanuel Cyril, were terminated, and they felt that they had been terminated unjustly. They went through various legal steps, which I do not recall. But in any case, there were more regular reports in Newsday, they used the adjective strife torn so frequently that we got to jocularly referring to our own institution as "old strife torn you," which you may remember later on when we all moved to Stony Brook, we called the place "old sump you" for other reasons. I don't have any clear idea or clear memory on the issues. They were, of course, in part related to the, shall we say, pro-Chicago, anti-Chicago, great books idea. There was considerable bitterness, and I don't want to pass that off lightly on account of the people on whom it, I guess, weighed excessively in terms of their personal futures. I'm pretty sure that those people would still speak very strongly about whatever it was that they went through at the time. That was one thing, the case of the three, and I think the most most notorious. It happened to coincide with those days, Oyster Bay, in which construction went on, and people were teaching in concert huts, mission huts, and other temporary structures. And there was a good deal of mud that you had to pass through on your way from one class to another.
Geodesic domes.
Geodesic domes, that's right. And the there was a controversy. It also got us into Newsday because one member of the Oyster Bay faculty, second or third year. At that time, or was this the fourth year? I can't remember. But one member had put a poem before his class to discuss. And this was a poem from Coney Island of the Mind by Lawrence Ferlinghetti. It was a poem in which Ferlinghetti used the beat idiom. He was looking pretty cool in there, kind of thing, to deal with the crucifixion and to bring out, as it were, the theme that Jesus Christ would repudiate some of those who take on Christianity in his name. But in any case, it was too difficult a poem for these students, and the words on the page to a person who didn't understand what was going on in the poem seemed sacrilegious. This eventually got to, strangely enough, I remember the name of the man. This eventually got to Representative DeRoonian, because a student in the class had passed the poem on to his father, and the father said, somebody's got to hear about this and do something about it. And he eventually got to the ears of Representative DeRoonian, who made a speech in some public place, and then after that there was a great flap about freedom of speech and freedom of teaching and so on and so forth. But Dean Olson was absolutely firm on this matter, and the thing finally faded away.
Mm-hmm.
It's not anything of great importance, but I think in and of itself it did demonstrate an attitude, and it was kind of minor crisis, which was well met, and I think surmounted with educational honor.
I see. When did Ben Nelson come? He was in sociology.
Yes, I remember Ben very well. Now, he came in the Oyster Bay days.
Yes.
And before we moved to this campus, and as a matter of fact, Ben was a source of irritation to a number of people, particularly me, because for at least a couple of years, I was secretary of something called the Executive Committee of the faculty, and since I had to make the notes, drop the minutes for this meeting, it was quite a chore, and I had got one of the secretaries, an older and experienced lady whom we all loved, to take notes, since she knew shorthand as I did not, and I would then work from her rough notes. I was taking very great care.
That wasn't Ann Jansen, was it?
No, it was not. It was Mrs. Grimm.
Mrs. Grimm.
And Mrs. Grimm used to beg me, please, don't ask me to go to another one of those meetings. Because they would very often be quite acrimonious, and I think largely because of the personality of Ben Nelson, who would very quickly, accuse people of some kind of bad faith when he wasn't playing some sort of intellectual game. And he also regularly used to insist that the minutes were quite incorrect, very often the members, the people would come to my support and say to him, but you did say that, and you said it several times. Oh, but you would say, I didn't mean that way, and so on and so forth. I perhaps make too much of this, but there were so many second sets of minutes that it took a great deal of my time. Therefore, be forgiven, perhaps, for remembering it. I recall a man who's now at Yale, went to Yale from us, a man in history. Don't remember.
Morris or Morse? Morse, I think.
Morse, I guess. And he discussed Ben Nelson with me, and we would confess that the man was a great perplexity to him. Ben, of course, had written, as you probably know, the article on casuistry in the Encyclopedia of the Social Sciences, therefore he employed his native talents whenever he discussed matters with people like Professor of History Morris and others.
He was an authority on casuistry.
Yes.
A practitioner.
And a practitioner, I would say.
Yes.
I never really figured out what he wanted to do except tie people up in knots, which he was rather successful.
Well, let's see.
If you make a shift to this place, I remember one of the elements in the transition. Some of us who were on the Oyster Bay faculty, when it was being changed into the University of Stony Brook, we knew that we were coming out here, and we settled or found places to live. I just remember another person in the original faculty, Len Gardner.
Yes, education.
In education.
Right.
Len Gardner was one of them. Bob Smolker was another.
Mm-hmm.
And I think Foster Ramirez, who had come along in the fourth year, was another. So that we had a kind of carpool group.
Oh, yes.
We first commuted to Oyster Bay for a couple of years. And that was amusing because we didn't want to take the same route all the time and had several different drivers. So I figured it out at the time. We had something like 8 different routes to go to Oyster Bay and to come back from there. Then, of course, we settled into this place, and those of us who were living here before the institution was actually operating on the campus had an opportunity to see it being built. I remember Nelson Rockefeller, who always made a great delight in these public ceremonies, coming out joyfully at the controls of a bulldozer, moving it about.
Remember what year that was? They broke ground
in 60.
In 60,
yeah.
I think you're right.
Yeah.
Yes, they actually broke ground in 60.
And Nelson was there breaking it with the latest modern equipment.
Yeah.
And then, of course, we had the interesting pleasure of seeing that the place being built up and eventually Nichols Road being constructed. I remember the first couple of weeks when it was not open to the public, yet Tom Rogers got on his bicycle and went down the whole route from 25A to Wisconsin Highway. He said it was a very good ride. The other things that I remember, of course, is that the Humanities Building was our first academic building.
Yeah.
Our first academic building in the... for everything, I think, matter of fact.
I think we had the Chemistry Building.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Humanities?
The first Science Building.
Chemistry was the first thing. And they had put it nearest the library.
Uh-huh.
Which was a tremendous mistake.
Yes, yes. I know that. And then, of course, the library itself was a problem. And when I heard about the solution to the inadequate size of the library, I could not believe it. But it turned out to be true. We will expand it on all four sides and on the top. And this indeed was what was done.
Well, there's nothing on the top.
Well, they did, I think, raise the... We put another story on, in addition to...
Not on top.
No.
It's around the sides, yes.
That's right.
Yes.
Right. It was, I suppose, a kind of educational version of the Pentagon, in a way.
Well...
With a hollow...
It was hard... I think it was hard to foresee...
Right.
Just what form the institution was going to take. So the early planning,
mm-hmm.
and I haven't yet, in anything that I've recorded, found out who did the early planning.
Oh, Voorhees and so forth. I just threw the thing into the wastebasket the other day. His brochure that showed the plan for the original library and the rest
you
of it.
You threw it in the wastebasket?
Yes, good heavens.
You should keep that.
I may have another. Look again.
Yeah, those things go to
it. It's Voorhees is in there as one of the architects.
Yes. Well, Clark and Rapallana was involved. That they had been, I think, Ward Melville's architects in some project. I don't know what. But they didn't. They didn't have a chance.
I remember part of the atmosphere here is that when the library is being expanded, and you probably remember this too, of course, the construction was such that a stranger would, I suppose, be as perplexed as I understand people are now when they try to get into the Louvre. They can't find the entrance. It was difficult because the entrance is also being shifted.
Yes.
And people were always going through tunnels of lumber on their way to the inside where the books were. And men were climbing over scaffolding in the expansion area and whistling at the girls, of course. And worse. In fact, there was even kind of scandal so that the secretaries got together and complained.
Well, unlike Albany, which had facilities downtown where they always had been.
Yeah.
School had to keep on the construction site. That was that made life extremely difficult. I remember one case of the boy who thought he would jump across one of the steam vents
mm-hmm.
and actually fell in and killed
yes,
himself.
Yes. I remember, of course, on the other side, a loud clamor that safety precautions were insufficient.
Right. Right.
And John Toll was much criticized in certain quarters, I thought, unjustly.
Let me ask you, were you one of the members of the group to which I was brought by Harry Porter in the office there in Coal Hall?
I think so, yes. I think so.
If you can remember, I remember I sat at the end of the table and Harry was on my right. What did you people know about me in advance?
We knew that you had been at Brookhaven. We knew that you were a historian by training and previous professional work. I don't know whether we knew at that time that you had been in the State University or whether you were coming into the State University system for the first time. I don't remember.
But you had no hand in selecting me. I was just being presented to you.
That's right. That's why I don't remember anything
yeah.
of that.
All right, well, now...
One discussion that I was privy to.
No. I know that I... That was my first introduction to the faculty.
I see. Mm-hmm.
And I wondered because previously, where I had been, I had always been presented to the faculty before my... No, I hadn't. I had been presented to the faculty before I was appointed dean at Cornell College. Had to go through that review, but not at Bucknell. Did you
well,
know?
Well, I suppose that whatever, if that seems rather irregular, and I suppose it was the consequence, was it not, of the, whatever you want to call it, the administrative difficulties following upon the President Lee's leaving.
Probably.
So that it was a strong hand from Albany that took over. I remember President Lee. Now, I hadn't thought about him until I just mentioned it. I remember one incident. Member of the council of
Stony Brook Council.
Stony Brook Council.
Yeah.
Had been looking about for a suitable trophy that could be used for the, I believe it was the Judge Sullivan, mentioned became to be the Judge Sullivan Award.
Right.
And